Honorable members, as per committee program, today we'll be taking and receiving a briefing by the South African Reserve Bank on the annual report and annual economic report. And later on, we'll then take the briefing by the Auditor General on the outcome of National Treasury as part of preparing for the IRR report. Governor Jim Marcus, Deputy Governor, Leslie Jahanya. I'm not sure if you have been here since you were appointed. Well, you missed your voice in the National Treasury. Today you are here in another capacity. The rest of the team, under the leadership of Governor Marcus, you're welcome. We did speak with your office that the approach to this meeting will be more flexible as a committee. You will then guide us on how you wish to handle your presentations so that it can be adequately better informed when you leave here, because indeed you come to brief the committee at a very, very interesting period. Not that it is much different from what it has always been. The economic outlook has not been very, very robust internationally, including our internal domestic challenges. And as part of preparing for a BRR report and also preparing for the medium-term budget policy statement, this input will really go a long way in assisting the committee to its work. I must also indicate that you are not meeting a full complement of the economy, because, and I think the culture that you started, that when people are in Parliament, they must also utilize the time to study. So most of them, or some of them, are actually writing exams. Mr. Goronoff is about, but the rest are either committed in terms of this program that you started when you were in Parliament many years ago. And some of us are also a product of that program. Over to you, Governor Marcus.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you to members for being here. The approach we would like to take, and obviously this appearance before the committee is a very important component of our accountability. And as many of you are no doubt aware, the bank's annual report was released towards in June, 28th of June. So we'll rarely talk to the report, but update you, because quite a bit of time has passed since then. We'll separately look at the annual economic report, and at the same time deal with issues that have arisen since the report was released, including the impact of developments currently in the United States and the global economy. Perhaps you are aware that the IMF again downgraded the growth rate for the world, particularly emerging markets, and that was released yesterday. We've also decided, we would like to inform you that we've also decided, after careful consideration, no longer to produce the annual economic report from next year. Our assessment is that the issues that are addressed in the quarterly bulletin, the monetary policy review, the financial stability review, are covered. That the issues raised in the annual economic report are largely covered there. And the main value added of the annual report was that it provides a longer-term review of issues than is the case with some of the other publications. And therefore, this perspective will be added to those other reports, so that particularly to the quarterly bulletin. So there will be some changes to that rather than an annual economic report. And we will continue to publish a review of monetary policy in the annual report, which is before you today. So then we'll ask Brian Kahn, who is the member of the MPC, advisor to the governor, to give an overview of recent economic developments in the second part of our presentation today, really guided by yourself as to whether, when we've done the annual report and the financials and so on, we take some questions then, or you can have questions ongoing as I present, and then move to the second leg of that. And I'd like to just introduce the team formally. From my left, Deputy Governor Kanyako, as you've said, and he will do a presentation to you on where we stand with the progress towards Twin Peak. So that is also an update that he will present this morning. We will also, Brian, I've introduced Negani Matebula, Head of Strategy and Communications, Nadine Ford-Hoon, who is our Chief Financial Officer for the group, and Gina Reynolds, who's the Company Secretary. So that's the team before you. What we'll do immediately after I've spoken is Nadine will do a short presentation, which you have had the slides on the financials, and we will then move to the Twin Peaks, and thereafter to the economic issues, if that's okay with you. Okay. The bank plays a unique role in the economy, performing our functions and exercising our responsibilities in the interest of the country and the economy as a whole, and we are not driven by our profit motive. The mandate of the bank continues to expand. The initiatives and actions taken to address the global financial crisis have placed increasing focus and demand on central banks, and the SARB is no exception. Financial stability is now made an explicit mandate. Regulatory reform of the prudential regulation of insurance and financial infrastructure moves into the bank. Increased responsibility for anti-money laundering combating the financing of terrorism has expanded the demands on the bank, which is also deemed to be the resolution authority in the event of systemic banking sector failure. In this context, we welcome the opportunity to highlight a number of the areas in the annual report. Changes to the structure of the annual report make it more accessible in our view and cover a number of key issues in the front part, including the challenges for central banks going forward, the report on monetary policy, the outcome for the year under review with an inflation rate of 5.6% and growth of 2.4%. Notwithstanding that our mandate is explicitly price stability in terms of the constitutional mandate, we do take account of what is happening to other areas in the economy and the particular growth is a factor there. In operational review, showing operational structure, this shows all the market operations, including a review of JIBAR that was conducted, as well as the key areas dealt with by different departments. The report presents brief profiles of the executive, of senior management, branch managers, and the board, as well as an overview of the subsidiaries. It covers the composition and structures of the internal committee, while Table A on page 57 covers the operational budget and capital expenditure. The governance report, including the compliance, risk management, remuneration, and human resources reports, start on page 59 of the report. It covers a wide range of issues. For instance, that our staff turnover has risen from 4.08% to 4.28%, considerably lower than the industry norm, stood at 10.9% at the time of writing the report. It also provides the details of our employment equity status. Corporate social investment is covered from page 70, while page 75 contains the key highlights of the group financial statements, including the loss after taxation of $1.4 billion for the group and $1.5 billion for the bank, compared with a loss of $491 million in the previous financial year. The income of the bank is mainly derived from returns on the investment of our foreign exchange reserves, and due to the prevailing low-yielding global environment, this is impacted upon. This is insufficient to cover the operational cost of the bank. In addition, the total income of the bank decreased by a further $282 million compared with the previous year, mainly due to a reduction in commission on banking services given the changing approach to the handling of cash, and I'm happy to explain further on that if you so wish. It's important to understand the nature of these losses as they are due to the unique nature of the central bank and arise from outperforming our functions in the interest of the economy and of the country. These losses are not a result of operational efficiencies or cost excesses, taking account of the expanding mandate and demands placed on the bank. A major source of our losses emanate from the accumulation and management of foreign exchange reserves. There is a need to increase the country's holding of foreign exchange reserves, which are low by comparison with our emerging market economy peers. For instance, the recent number for us is $50 billion, compared with Brazil, which is slightly below $400 billion, or China, at $3.5 billion. There's also a measure that the IMF uses to see whether you are below the levels that they think appropriate. The need to accumulate these reserves has been driven by the need to reduce our vulnerability to sudden large outflows of capital, something which is regarded as a real risk given the policy decisions likely to be taken by the Federal Reserve in the near future. We've made good progress in this regard over the past 10 years, with gross gold and foreign exchange reserves increasing from $8 billion in June 2003 to the current level of $50 billion. However, reserve accumulation is not without its cost. When the bank purchases a foreign exchange, it injects rand liquidity into the market. Unless we neutralize this liquidity increase, it could have inflationary consequences. There are a variety of ways that we can mop up this excess liquidity. For example, through issuing of a reserve bank debentures. This process is known as sterilization. However, while we pay 5% the current repo rate on these debentures, we earn very little on our holding of foreign exchange reserves because we have normally low interest rates in the advanced economies. And it is the currencies of these countries that are held as our reserves, the US dollar in particular. As the cost of sterilization and the low returns on foreign currency holdings continue to impact the financial results of the bank and therefore also the top group. Clearly, we could improve our financial performance by not accumulating reserves or by reducing our reserve holdings. However, this would not be in the interest of the country as a whole, particularly as our reserves are considered to still be on the low side, and over time we will need to continue to build up our reserves. A further contributing factor to the increased losses relates to the bank's role as the sole issuer of currency. The introduction of a new currency series involves high initial fixed costs for a number of years, as the stocks are built up, including the buffer stocks required. It's important to bear in mind that the notes in circulation exceed 110 billion rand and increase at about 10% per annum. And therefore, if you have to have sufficient stock, you need to take account of what is your peak demand, for instance, in December, and have enough to ensure that there is sufficient currency in circulation for that. And that requires production of that quantum. Losses that have been incurred have been met by drawing down from the bank's contingency reserve, which is reflected on page 90 of the report, which has been built up from previous profits precisely for this reason. This reserve stands at just over 6 million rand at the moment. I'd then like to hand, unless any questions from what I've raised so far, I'd like to hand over to Nadine to talk through the financials. And after her, it will be Dr. Gamakanyako on the printing.
Thank you, Governor. Good morning to the members of the committee. I will be presenting on the group annual financial statements for the year ended 31 March 2013, and I thought I would just start by explaining what we need for the group. So the first slide really covers the group, and we have four wholly owned subsidiaries. The first one being the Corporation for Public Deposits, that's governed by the Corporation for Public Deposits Act, CPDA. And it accepts call deposits from the public sector and invests in short-term money market instruments. It has an independent board, and which is appointed by the Minister of Finance, and surplus profits after providing for whatever reserves are required are transferred to government. Then we have the South African Banknote Company. It's registered in terms of the Companies Act, and it produces banknotes, and it also has an independent board and subcommittee. South African Mint Company, registered in terms of the Companies Act as well, and produces coin and also has independent board and subcommittees. And we have the South African Reserve Bank Captive Assurance Company, SARBCIC for short, and that is registered in terms of the Companies Act as a public company, carries out short-term insurance business for the bank and its subsidiaries, so it really is only for internal purposes, and it has an independent board and subcommittees, and that's what constitutes the SARB group. When we look at the financial highlights for 2012 and 2013, these were some of the items that I wish to highlight. The rand depreciated over the year from 7.67 to 9.20 against the US dollar. So quite a substantial depreciation, resulting in increases in the gold and foreign exchange holdings, and that you'll see on the asset side of the balance sheet, as well as the JAFECRA, which is the gold and foreign exchange contingency reserve account, and that's really the liability side of the balance sheet. Further, the gold price increased to 14,742 rand per fine ounce from 12,793 rand in 2012. So quite a substantial increase as well in the gold price, and that contributed to increasing the gold reserve. Gold holdings increased by 2,246 fine ounces, so really a small increase there. The SA banknote was recapitalized through a subordinated loan of 1.1 billion in order to finance the factory modernization program, so we went through a process of bringing new equipment. The current year drawdown was 543 million and in the prior year 580 million. When we look at the statement of comprehensive income, the income statement, we've got a column there for group and bank. And you can see that predominantly the results are being driven by the bank side. If we look at interest income, we can, and I think what I'll do here is just cover what really, what is contained in each line item. So if we look at interest income, really what we have there is largely derived from investing, the interest income largely derived from investing in the country's foreign reserves and the return recognized thereon, including the coupon received as well as changes in fair value of the foreign financial instruments. It also includes interest on accommodation to banks, and that is basically the short-term lending to commercial banks. And we have interest from ESSA government bonds included in there, and those are used in conducting monetary policy. Under the interest expense line, we have interest paid on deposits. We have reverse repurchase agreements, interest on their debentures, call deposits. The debenture, reverse repos, and foreign exchange swap are instruments used in conducting open market operations and are used to sterilize the excess liquidity in the markets, as mentioned earlier by the governor, which is generated when we purchase foreign exchange. In the other income line, we have commission receipts on foreign transactions, banking services, dividends received on our BIS shares that we own. And under operating costs, we have personnel costs, operating costs, and the cost of currency, which is your banknotes and coins. As the governor has already mentioned, the bank has made a loss after tax in the current year of 1.5 billion compared to the prior year of 491 million rand. Net interest income has increased by 232 million from the prior year. Other income has decreased by 513 million, mainly due to declining commission earned on cash handling at the branches, and that's where the governor said she would elaborate if you needed further elaboration. Operating costs, we've had an increase of 1.1 billion from last year, mainly due to the following. Higher staff costs as a result of the annual increment of 7%. There was an increase in headcount that is necessary to support the latest regulatory requirements, and there was also a net increase in the post-employment benefit actuarial valuations, and that mainly was as a result of a lower discount rate and higher medical inflation. And then in November 2012, the new Mandela Note series, banknote series, was launched, resulting in a higher cost of new currency compared to the prior year, and that was 819 million. I think it's important, and the governor mentioned it as well, just to highlight that the losses were incurred in the execution of the bank's public duties and do not in any way relate to operational deficiencies or undue risk being taken. The bank has a sound risk management framework, a disciplined budgeting process, and prudent expenditure management. Once the bank returns to profitability, the bank will need to rebuild this contingency reserve that we have, and it will have to consider the appropriate level taking into account past 3 years' losses. When we look at the group, loss after taxation, this is just a summary of the subsidiaries' net profit contribution to the group loss. We can see the CPD, Corporation for Public Deposit, last year it made a profit of 50 million, this year 98 million, most of which is transferred to government after providing for a contingency reserve. Then we have the SMN, last year with a loss of 10 million, this year 5 million loss, that's come down. The SA banknote, last year had a loss of 146 million, this year it has broken even. The main reason for the SA banknote loss last year was they had taken out foreign exchange contracts for that modernization program in terms of purchasing the equipment, and that was still an unrealized loss. At the end of March 2013, all the equipment has been delivered, and that's why we've got, that position was closed out. Then with SARCIC, which is insurance cell captive, last year it made a profit of 5 million, this year 2 million loss, and that was mainly due to internal insurance claims. And as you can see, the subsidiaries contributed in 2013 91 million rand towards the loss of 1.5 billion of the bank, giving us a net loss for the group of 1.408 billion. When we look at the statement of financial position, which is the balance sheet, we can see that total assets, both for the bank and the group, have increased by 75 and 76 billion respectively, And we will see their gold and foreign exchange holding increased by 71 billion. And that's a top line. 8 billion was due to the gold price increase and 63 billion due to the depreciation of the rand. The next line, which is total liabilities of the bank increased by 77 billion and the group increased also by 77 billion. The JAFECRA, which is the gold and foreign exchange contingency reserve account, that increased by 58 billion due to the increases in gold price and the depreciation of the rand. Hudson Coin in circulation increased by 13 billion and deposit accounts, mainly the bank's reserve accounts, increased by 8 billion. And the contingency reserve of the bank, as we've talked about, decreased by 1.5 billion, which was the loss of the bank, leaving us with a balance of 6 billion as at 31 March 2013. Thank you.
I don't have any questions there. Let's get more.
Thank you very much, Chair and committee members. Good to be back here. At the time I had captured earlier on the recent developments and the fact that we are still in a global financial crisis. Every year we think that we are in the middle of it, but it doesn't look like the end is inside. The global financial crisis led to significant changes in an approach to regulation around the world. There are a number of significant international processes to reform the regulatory architecture. South Africa didn't have to make any significant interventions to bail out any of our domestic financial institutions thanks to a very robust regulatory framework and a very robust supervisory framework. Still, we were not complacent. We have to look and see what is it that we can improve in our regulatory framework. So in 2011, the Legislative Assembly published a policy document. The document is called Building a Safer Financial Sector That Serves South Africa Better. It is commonly referred to as the Red Book. Why it is called the Red Book, I do not know. When I checked the budget documentation, they are all Red Books, but this one was specifically called the Red Book. And it is in essence captures what was going to be the new regulatory architecture for South Africa, which is basically the Twin Peak framework. The concept itself is used as Twin Peak, but when you look very closely, you will see that it is called Twin Peak because three of the peaks are actually within the Reserve Bank, and the other peak is in what is called the market conduct regulator. The process is driven by a steering committee composed of the National Treasury, the Financial Services Board, the South African and South African Reserve Bank. And in 2013, this year, earlier in the year, a further document was released called Implementing the Twin Peak Regulatory Framework in South Africa, what is also commonly referred to as the roadmap. And we expect that next year, 2014, legislation will be brought through Parliament, and then the establishment of the architecture will take place. The overall architecture is captured in four areas, which might look like four peaks, as I said, but it's got three of the peaks are actually in the sub, hence the concept of twin peak. The first peak refers to microprudential supervision, which is consolidating the prudential regulation of insurance and banks into the South African Reserve Bank in one area that looks specifically at the soundness of the individual institutions.
And then the second peak being that of market conduct regulator, area of market conduct will be consolidated within the financial services board. And the third area, which is something that the Reserve Bank has been doing over the years as an implicit mandate but was never given the legal authority to do, which is in what is called macroprudential regulatory space, also commonly referred to as the financial stability mandate. In terms of the Twin Peaks document, what this would entail is that the Reserve Bank will now be given an explicit mandate in law to be responsible for macroprudential regulation. The third area which I have in a bit shaded is the resolution framework. In the international discourse on financial regulation, one of the things that came was the work done by the Global Financial Stability Board, which captured in what are called the key attributes of a sound resolution framework. And South Africa will also have to give effect to those key attributes, and that would entail us having to create the resolution framework. That resolution framework would be created within the Reserve Bank and will form part of the macroprudential piece. We are designing this regulatory architecture in order to address fairly important but interdependent policy objectives. And these policy objectives are sometimes seen as one or the other. But in the manner in which they have been captured in the Twin Peaks document is that these policy objectives are interdependent. Right at the top is the area of market conduct, which deals with the issues of consumer protection in financial services, access to the financial services, and also more importantly, the integrity of the markets that operate. And on the left is the prudential regulation, which refers to the safety and soundness of the individual financial institution. Well, you could have financial institutions that are sound, but then you might be missing things that things are interconnected. There might be things that cut across the institutions which might be important. And this is then captured in the third policy objective, that of financial stability. This objective has to do with mitigating systemic risks. It goes beyond looking at the individual institution and looking at the system as a whole and say, to what extent can system as a whole be compromised by risks that emanate either from interconnectedness or from risks that emanate from outside of the financial system, and then what are the steps that get taken by the policymakers to make sure that these risks are actually mitigated. So the Twin Peaks architecture, the way in which then it would look like, the one peak being the prudential peak, which would cover banking, insurance, conglomerate supervision. It would also look at anti-money laundering and the combating of the financing of terrorism supervision. This has become very important because, as you see international flows take place, there are obligations on an international basis that we have, that if institutions, domestic institutions, are found not to be compliant with those, could actually pose a risk to our system because some of the institutions might be shut out of the international financial system. And the last part in the prudential peak is what is called FMI supervision. These are financial market infrastructure such as the national payment systems, central counterparties, and trade repositories. This is a relatively new area. Central banks have always been looking after national payment systems. What has not been done has been that there are these new emerging areas. There are international obligations that say that all over-the-counter derivatives must be centrally cleared. And what is now emerging is that you have to have central clearing counterparties. And the world over, there are about two of these things. So what is happening is that you might have created new significant financial market infrastructures. But if those significant financial market infrastructures fail, then you are facing significant domestic financial stability risks. And the question then would be, how do you effect then the principles of sound financial market infrastructure, which are agreed to by IOSO and the Committee on Payment and Settlement and Payment System. On the right is the contract SIC, which basically looks at consumer protection and fairness, looks at the issues of financial inclusion, looks at market integrity, and more importantly, that a consumer that is literate, that is well-informed, is one of your best defenses in the market conduct area. So the issue of financial literacy then also gets captured more importantly in the market conduct field. Where are we now in terms of the implementation? The policy was formulated and was released in February 2011. The minister and the governor established a steering committee that oversees the implementation of the framework, and this was done in May 2011. And then in November and December 2011, we embarked on a scoping exercise which started with an international conference that involved experts from different countries so that we could compare across the globe. It also involved a study tour by the members of the steering committee to the various jurisdictions that had implemented the Twin Peaks framework. Earlier this year, we continued with a document. We developed that document further. We came with an implementation document that was released in February this year. It involved consultation with stakeholders so that when we developed the legislation, we would have been informed from the discourse with the various stakeholders. And then later this year, we will then be looking at the drafting of legislation, which we expect that will only come to Parliament next year. The process of the drafting of the legislation is led by the National Treasury, and the legislation will come in two phases. The first phase will entail the creation of that regulatory architecture, establishing the Twin Peaks, and thus begin to migrate stuff into the respective piece. Phase two will involve consolidation of regulatory powers and aligning them to the Twin Peaks framework, and this is estimated to be implemented roughly around 2016. This does not mean that regulation is not taking place. Regulation will continue to take place because we have got existing legislation. And then the National Treasury will be leading the process of bringing the legislation through into Parliament, and this should also lay the basis that for the two bits to start the strategic planning for the implementation of the remaining parts of the reform process. And lastly, the preparatory work within the staff has already started. The staff integration from the FSB to the staff is estimated that about 52 people will be integrated in the South African Reserve Bank. What we have found unique in South Africa is that unlike in other jurisdictions, there was no need to move anybody from the staff to the FSB because the staff was not doing any market conduct regulation, and that we would have ongoing implementation review in the light of the major impact on internal governance and resources. This last part is very important because the world over what we see is that passing the legislation is one thing. The most crucial thing is dealing with people. And it is that stage that is most crucial for us that we are paying particular attention to. That, Chair, is where we are today.
Yes. This was not the last presentation from your side.
This was the presentations, and then we would move to the economic issues.
Okay.
So if you wanted to deal with this, which really relates to the annual report separately, we're guided by you.
Yeah. I think when it comes to questions and answers, it may be difficult not to link the economy and the presentation it will be better that we deal with everything. Same priority comes to the grand members of the grand challenge into the economic arena. Over to you, Kana.
Thank you, Chair. Members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to present recent economic developments to you. It is to some extent a review of our annual economic report, but because the report came out quite a while ago, it is more updated than what you will see in the annual economic report. Also, I apologize, there are one or two slides that are included in my presentation here that are not in the pack, but I thought it would be useful to include them because they do illustrate some of the points. Last line of my presentation is basically a very brief overview of the international environment, then looking at the South African economy and monetary policy in particular. Now, starting off with the international scene, as was mentioned earlier, we are still in the crisis. We're still trying to get out of the crisis, and there is what appears to be a multi-speed recovery taking place in a global economy. Firstly, there are signs of recovery in the US, but having said that, there are important headwinds that are expected, primarily from the fiscal side. As we know, early on in the year, there was quite a sharp fiscal contraction in the US, which reduced growth in the US, but that impact was expected to reduce over time, but now we have the issues of the budget impasse and the debt ceiling coming up. And we can talk a bit more about that later if necessary, but if these issues do not get resolved, it will have serious implications for the global economy. The other headwind that is possible facing the U.S. is the withdrawal of monetary stimulus, the talk about tapering, and I'll come back to that in a couple of minutes. But basically, as we talk about withdrawing monetary stimulus happens, long-term interest rates in the U.S. start increasing, and that in turn slows down the pace of recovery. So that is part of the headwinds and downside risk to the U.S. growth outlook. The Eurozone has emerged from recession, which it has been in for quite a few quarters, but growth is expected to be very slow for some time, which is bad news for us given our strong cravings with the region. But at least the risks of a disorderly breakup of the system have receded, but it still is some sort of tail risk. The UK is showing signs of improvement. The Japanese outlook is more uncertain. There has been a lot of monetary policy stimulus taking place, but it's still early days to know to what extent the recovery that we are seeing will be sustained. The bad news is that the growth, which we saw in the emerging markets and which was the main driver of global growth in the last couple of years, that growth has now been slowing down. It's intensified by the tight financial conditions because of the U.S. Stimulus withdrawal, or talk about the stimulus withdrawal. And we've seen the slowdown and projected slowdowns, particularly in the BRICS, with Brazil, Russia, India, and China slowing down in particular. But fortunately, the outlook for Africa in general remains positive. Now, if we look at the U.S., just to mention in slightly more detail what is happening in the U.S. And we're focusing on this because it is so fundamentally important for how we see the global environment going forward, is that what the U.S. has been talking about is not a tightening of monetary policy. It's really slowing down in the pace of expansion of liquidity. So whereas up to now they've been buying $85 billion worth of bonds every month, they're talking about reducing that pace of stimulus. The market reaction, however, to the announcement on May the 22nd by Ben Bernanke that they were thinking of doing that, the reaction was almost as if they were starting to tighten monetary policy, and they'd made it clear that they probably only would start raising interest rates by about 2015 or 2016. But the problem is the market reacted very strongly. U.S. long
bond rates went up quite strongly, and we saw a major withdrawal of capital from the emerging markets back into the U.S. bond rates in emerging markets and in other advanced economies as well pick up quite strongly. And you can see in this graph, which unfortunately is not in your pack, but if you look at the these are bond flows to emerging market economies, we can see that there was strong movement in 2010, 11, and 12, and then suddenly this very strong outflow of bond finance from the emerging markets. So this impact is enormous. When September came along and the beginning of the tapering was supposed to start and it didn't happen, there was some reversal of that. But what it does illustrate to us is that every time there's going to be talk about tapering or any action, I think we're in for lots of volatility. In terms of the other international developments of importance to us, we can see that commodity prices have been generally moderating. We saw in 2009 to 2011 a strong uptick in commodity prices. These have started to moderating mainly because of the slowdown in China, and that of course has important implications for us as a commodity producing country. And then finally, the other aspect of importance for us is the behavior of the international oil price. In the last few months, we've seen it fluctuating between about $105 per barrel to about 118. And the main driver there have been issues such as the global growth outlook, but more in particular has been the risks related to events, particularly in the Middle East, for example, in Syria and in Egypt and Iran. And that tends to push the oil price in that range at this point in time. Now, moving into the South African economy, as we show in our annual economic review, part of the problem that we've been facing for over a long period has been the fact that our expenditure, our final demand, has generally exceeded the growth in expenditure, has exceeded our growth in output, and that really implies a persistent current account deficit. It's another way of looking at the current account deficit, or the fact that our savings is insufficient to finance our investment. When we look at our growth performance, we can see that in the second quarter we had growth of 3%, relative to the previous quarter, where it was really anemic 0.9%, but the 3% growth is not something to be very happy about. It doesn't mean to say we're growing at 3%. This is a quarterly annualized number, and for the annual rate it's closer to 2%. So we really are growing at 2% rather than 3%, and our forecast for this year is growth of around 2%, which is pretty much in line with consensus. And as you know, a growth of 3% is probably consistent with employment remaining at current levels. 2% growth is not very good, therefore, and we really need about 5% growth to make significant inroads into the unemployment story. The recovery that we saw in the second quarter was mainly driven by the recovery in the manufacturing sector, which had a very strong contraction in the first quarter. But unfortunately, I think the third quarter outlook is not very good. There's no doubt that the third quarter is going to be adversely affected by the strike, particularly in the motor vehicle and component sector. And we've also already seen the purchasing managers index having been in positive territory for quite some for the last few months. The latest reading was negative, implying some expected contraction in that sector. And here we also see the mining sector in the second quarter has contracted, and the outlook is not very positive given the, again, work stoppages that we've seen in that sector. Now, moving on to domestic expenditure, we have seen domestic expenditure moderating, which is good news in part. We have seen consumption expenditure, which has been the main driver of growth in 2010, 11, and 12, particularly 10 and 11, has been moderating, and now consumption expenditure has come down to about 2.5%. Investment expenditure is still very weak at 2.7% growth, and government expenditure 2.1%. If we look at the private sector fixed capital formation, that has picked up a little bit in the fourth quarter, but it's still growing at around between 3 and 4% per annum. Again, simply not good enough. Part of the weakness of investment expenditure has to do with lack of confidence by the private sector, but also the fact that it's unutilized capacity in the economy, which is not conducive to new investment. Household consumption, as I said, has been moderating quite significantly. The red line that you see there is the consumer confidence index, and it seems to have recovered a bit in the second quarter, which was a bit of a surprise, I think, to everyone that there was a sharp recovery. But in the third quarter, we've seen the consumer confidence now has fallen to its lowest level for well over 10 years, and even lower at the peak of the financial crisis. So that is not very good news for the outlook for consumption expenditure. Household debt is still relatively high. It seems to have been flattened out at about 75% of household disposable income. But the debt service cost is at this point still low, partly because, for a large extent, due to the low interest rate environment. Of course, any change in the interest rate environment would affect that ratio. Overall, domestic savings still remained low and has in fact declined, and that's again reflected in the current account deficit, which we'll get to. The government is still this saving, and they're part of the counter-cyclical policy after years of net savings in the of government being contributing to gross savings. We have now seen a decline. We have seen government saving, which was the response to the recession. Household savings remains very low at about 1.7% of GDP, and most of the savings is being done in the corporate sector. but as I mentioned, the ratio is about 13.3% of GDP. Compared to an investment ratio of about 19%. So there's a very big gap that needs to be financed between savings and investment. Bank credit extensions have remained pretty moderate increases of around 9% year on year. Of significance is the moderation that we have seen in unsecured lending. The blue line, which is other loans and advances, shows how most of that is driven by unsecured lending, particularly to households. And what we have seen, if you look at it over a three-month basis or more short-term basis, we have seen a very sharp drop in the pace of growth of unsecured lending. And in fact, in the most recent period, we have seen a contraction in that. So there's definitely been a slowdown in that area, and that will, of course, affect the consumption expenditure outlook going forward. When we look at employment growth here, this is an area of concern not only to us but to the whole economy, that employment growth has been extremely weak. If you look over the year, from June to the end of June 2012 to end of June 2013, we saw formal sector growth of, I think it was 0.1%. We had net increase in employment of 7,000 workers, and that included a fall in of about 26,000 or 23,000 workers in the mining sector, and another 7,000 net decline in employment in construction and manufacturing, whereas there was a 26,000 increase in public sector, in the personal and community services. So the private sector is not increasing employment, and had it not been for the public sector, for the government sector, we would have seen a net decline over the year. As I said before, our current rates of growth are not conducive to significant increases in employment creation in the private sector. At the same time, real wages have been increasing. We have seen an increase in sharp increase in real wages and salaries over the past period. As you can see, the top line is the real salaries and wages per worker on average. There has been an increase in productivity, so the red line is the real unit labor cost increase, so that's adjusting for those productivity increases. In nominal terms, we do see the unit labor costs are now running at about just under 7% year-on-year. The Andrew Levy surveys show wage settlements of around 8%, and so we are seeing this uptick in labor costs coming through in the economy. And moving on to the exchange rate, we all know about what's been happening to the exchange rate. Since about May last year, we have seen the rand depreciating, firstly because of the news of the widening current account and the balance payments. A whole range of domestic and external factors were impacting on the rand over that period. But I think this graph is very telling, because what it shows here is that until about the second quarter of 2012, if you look at the red line and the gold line, the red line is is our effective exchange rate, and here we define it in terms of a higher movement is a depreciation or weakening of the currency. We can see that until about May of last year, we moved very much in line with the other emerging markets. And so our currency was dominated basically by external events rather than domestic internal factors. And what was driving all emerging market currencies was predominantly risk perceptions relating to Europe. When things were looking bad in Europe, it was risk off. Money was moved out of emerging markets back into the advanced economies. When it was risk on again, we had the reverse flows. But since May last year, when news of the current account widening, when we saw the current account deficit widening, and then the range of other domestic factors such as labor issues, etc., we saw a decoupling of the rand from other emerging markets. We weakened much more than they did. Although in recent times, we can see that there has been some co-movement related to the tapering story as well. One of the impacts of these, an important impact of the tapering remarks and the depreciation has been the impact on our long-term bond yields. Interestingly, if you look at the long bond yields, which is the we have seen. If you look at the blue line, that is the exchange rate. The red line is the long-term bond yield. And interestingly, even though the exchange rate was depreciating during 2012, we did see long-term bond yields declining. Following the tapering story, we saw a very sharp uptick in long-term bond yields, and by almost 1.5 percentage points, which is very bad news, not only for longer-term investment, but also for the cost of financing future government debt. The share prices, I won't go into that, but our trend has been to follow international development. Now, all that, as I've mentioned before, and that has come through in some of these, some of the discussion, has been the issue of the current account deficit. We have seen that widening since the third quarter last year, with 6.8% of GDP, 6.5%, and then narrowing to 5.8 and back to 6.5. I have added in this graph, which is not in the pack, just to illustrate that the top graph shows the trade account, and we can see that in 2019-11 we had a trade account surplus, but an overall deficit is reflected in the red bars because of the payments of income and services. But in 2012 and 2013, we saw the trade account moving into deficit as well, and that led to the widening of the overall current account deficit. And here we can see the reason why very clearly, that if you look at the real exports, if you look at real imports, blue line, we can see those have been increasing quite sharply in the last 2 or 3 years. This is a longer term perspective. From 1990, we see a general upward trend in real imports. It came down in 2008 during the crisis, which then contributed to the narrowing of the deficit. But since then, it has been picking up over the last 2-3 years in volume terms. But the bad news is on the export side. And here we can see very clearly that our current account deficit is widening, widening mainly because exports have been, they declined during the recession, during the peak of the crisis as expected in line with most other emerging markets, but we didn't recover our exports the way other emerging markets did. In volume terms, they've been pretty flat. We simply aren't exporting enough, whether it's mining or other manufacturing. And at the same time, if you look at the bottom graphs, you can see towards the end, these are our terms of trade. And we saw right in the beginning the commodity prices had been declining. So our decline in terms of trade means that not only are we exporting less in volume terms, but the prices that we are getting are moderating as well. So overall, in value terms, not a very positive story, and that really does point to the need to focus on getting the export story right. It's very difficult to, if we want to solve the balance of payments problem, it's very easy to say, well, reduce imports, but a lot of our imports are intermediate intermediate or final capital goods, which are essential for our infrastructure expenditure program. For example, Transnet or Eskom or whatever it may be. So it's not very easy to reduce that without reducing fixed investment, whereas the way to really do it is to make sure that exports are improved. The net purchases of, we have to obviously finance that deficit, and in the current environment that has become more difficult to finance, as we saw before, that bond flows to emerging markets are becoming more fickle. What we have seen over the last 2 years in 2011 and 2012, in 2011 we had bond flows to the value of about 44 billion rand, in 2012 about 88 billion rand. So far this year it's around about 17 or 18 billion rand, but we did see at the time of tapering, the tapering announcement, an outflow of about 17 billion, 17 billion. So we had a very strong reaction to that. So the bottom line is that these flows are becoming, they're still there, and we did see strong inflows again in September, as you can see that green line, but it is a more uncertain environment. The wall of money that was going from the advanced economies into the emerging markets isn't as much a wall anymore as it was, and it's becoming a bit more discerning. I won't say much about the fiscal policy side of things. I'm sure you have been briefed and will be briefed on the MTBPS. Suffice to say that fiscal policy has been countercyclical, which accounts for the widening deficit over the downturn in recent years. Just a couple of minutes on monetary policy and inflation. Inflation had been within the target range for about 14 months continuously, and then in the last 2 months in July and August, as predicted, and we had predicted this for some time, that we would be outside the target in the third quarter, so in July and August it was 6.3 and 6.4% respectively. We expect that inflation, the headline inflation, will return back within the target range by the fourth quarter, or during the fourth quarter, and then to remain within the target range for the rest of our forecast period, which goes to the end of 2015, I think. The underlying inflation, or what we refer to as core inflation, which excludes food, petrol, and electricity, which is the blue line you can see, has been more comfortably inside the target range, but it has been on an upward trend, although it has seemed to have flattened out around the 5% the 5% level. Our response to our monetary policy response over the past few years has been in response to the fact that inflation had been in a target range, although more recently uncomfortably towards the top, but we did have a wide output gap. In other words, output growth was quite weak. And as you can see, that for the last couple of years, the real repo rate has been negative in the sense that it had been lower than the rate of inflation, whether you measured it on, in terms of current inflation or expected inflation. We do have a negative repo rate, implying an, quite an accommodative monetary policy stance. But we are concerned that there are risks, upside risks to inflation, which make our dilemma a bit more acute, given that we have these upside risks and downside risks to output. We do see some signs of inflation coming in the pipeline. If you look at the producer price index, that is now up to about 6.7%, the last reading. And also, our biggest risk, as we see it, comes from the exchange rate depreciation. But as we know, as the rand depreciates, it does mean that imported prices go up, but the pass-through to consumer prices has not been as high as it has been in previous episodes of depreciation, and we think that is because of the weak state of the economy that prices can't simply be passed on to consumers as easily as in other episodes when you've got a stronger demand situation. But nevertheless, we still see this as a risk. So just in summary, we've got the upside risk to inflation as we see them as coming from the exchange rates, from labor costs, from food prices. Food prices have been picking up, but some of the good news is that global food prices have been declining, so there may be some offsetting pressures there. And again, administered prices, that should read including petrol prices, administered prices, including petrol prices, have been consistently above the inflation target, whereas our downside pressures and risk to inflation come from the fragile growth outlook and moderating consumer demand. So just by summary, we see a difficult international and domestic economic environment. Persistent current accounts and fiscal deficits require stable financing, and current currency with twin deficits are most vulnerable to capital reversals. This means, and as I stressed before, there's an urgent need to increase our exports. Sluggish growth in South Africa, limited job creation, and our forecast for growth is for 2% for this year, 3.3% and 3.6% in the following 2 years. Inflation is expected to return to target in the final quarter of this year. But as we have seen in our most recent monetary policy statement, that the potential for further monetary accommodation is limited given these inflation pressures, and the dilemma facing monetary policy does continue, that we have a fragile growth environment, but upside risks to the inflation outlook. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Governor and your team. I think, honorable members, this is quite very elaborate presentation, and probably where we are, we've got lots of questions to answer, to ask, and they've got lots to answer. But I thought for now we should actually take a 10 minutes break so that we can get your thought processes right when we come back. We just fire into the real issues. And for the media, the governor would be here until the end of this meeting. So interviews, you can make them probably later. For now, what I'm asking is that he must be given an opportunity to drink tea with all of us. It's very fresh. Thank you. Leg stretch? Tea? Thank you, honorable members, government, your team. Honorable members, I guess you are ready with your questions.
Honorable Ross, I said I'll give you the first opportunity. So I'm formalizing what I said to you informally.
That's an unpleasant surprise.
Madam Minnie will be the second. Honorable Harris, third. And May Judith Chawalala. In that order.
Thank you, Chairperson. If I understood correctly, there was an indication that the annual economic report would be discontinued. I'm just very pleased to see that we still have the wonderful reports with regard to the present state of the economy, and that's most helpful. We hope that can still continue. And of course, Governor, we still appreciate your open and frank remarks with regard to the current state of the economy. I think we spoke about the stagflation problems in the past. And with regards to the bad news of a further decline in the economic growth rate of now 2%, and then a rise in inflation of outside our anticipated bracket of 6%, 6.2%, 6.3% now currently, it shows that stagflation is a real problem and it needs to be addressed. Perhaps your views on addressing this problem. I think we've made some progress with regards to the one of the main drivers of inflation, and that is the administered prices that needs to be closer to inflation-related prices. There was a lot of inputs made to NERSA, and I think NERSA, the regulator, did us proud in at least getting the prices down from 60% increase in electricity pricing to 8%. I think it's a step in the right direction. There is still some work to be done. But we are speaking about the infrastructure roles, and I was... You know, and if we talk about the proposed nuclear plants to come up, and there's perhaps an alternative application from Eskom to NERSA in terms of pricing that will put us back into the 20% brackets, those are concerning issues for the economy of South Africa and implications it will have on job creation, etc. But I think we are making strides to get the electricity pricing and funding these infrastructure in the shorter term away from increased tariffs, but rather on alternative funding methodologies like longer term loans, the finance from overseas at better rates, etc. But just your opinion in terms of the stagflation problems increasing, and with regards to the productivity and economic growth rate, I'm sure you will we share your concerns with regards to the crisis in the mining sector and also the crisis in terms of unemployment. And that also brings me to the issue of the problems with regards to investments and perhaps consumer confidence and also lack of confidence of business to invest in South Africa to create those jobs. Is it not because of the high electricity prices, the cost of water, and perhaps over-regulated issues with regards to labor? And I'd like to have your views on that if it's possible. With regards to closer home, with regards to the group loss of $1.4 billion, Madam, your reference to contingency reserves that is $6 billion at this point in time. What would be the desired level of the contingency reserves or the Reserve Bank be? And also in comparison perhaps to international standards, are we moving in that direction? Is there a possibility that we could increase these contingency reserves? And how relevant are those contingency reserves in terms of stability for the bank? Do you find it to be very relevant, or is it just an administrative reserve that you're working on? Thank you for the presentation with regards to the regulation. And we are grateful that South Africa has done us proud in the past in terms of the regulation, that we were spared most of the pain that we saw in the international domain. The regulation, and I think you've highlighted that the Reserve Bank will play a leading role in terms of the twin peaks in terms of regulation, that you will be addressing three of those components. But we've seen in the past just the regulation and the thorny issue of regulation in terms of property schemes and the property developments, which is a complex type of regulation. We've seen the intervention of the Reserve Bank in terms of the share max issue. And it's a funny issue that seems to resurface every time. And on my desk, I get thousands of letters from 40,000 investors that were, so to speak, left in the lurch because of this investment. And I believe it's all about the timing of the interventions and that we need to put the record right. I have at my disposal the issue of interventions or directives that were issued by the Reserve Bank and that was then re-reversed because of the court action. and I think that refers back to a delta of that, and your views on that. And we are open to have an interview with the Reserve Bank because it will take a lot of time in terms of these regulations. Of course, we are in favor of moving towards the twin peak of regulation. And I'm proud to say and glad to say today that we know that it's an inclusive approach with members of the industry, especially ASISA, and I've seen joint statements from the Reserve Bank, from the Minister and ASISA in this regard, because we have a very well established financial sector, and we would like to keep it at that. We know that it's a world-class sector, well appreciated in terms of international standards, and that we think in terms of the regulatory requirement that it should be worked out together with the private sector. And I think it is being done. But the thorny issue in terms of property syndicates or so-called Ponzi schemes and the position where the people are in invested in those property schemes because of the directives issued by the Reserve Bank, which was now reserved in terms of a court case. What would your views be on that? If it's possible that we can have an in-depth discussion with us, Madam Governor, I will appreciate that. Thank you so much. Thank you, Chair.
Given the wide range in the issues, I suggest we deal with this question first before we take others, if that's okay with you. Okay. I'll start, but I'll ask my colleagues to also add. And let me perhaps start with the question of the reserves, and I mean the question of group losses and contingency reserves. So the question, as we said, is that because you do your job, what is the right level? You know, the Bank International done a survey of central banks. At our request, at our initiative, in terms of what is international best practice. And there really is a wide range. Some banks make permanent losses, some banks don't. And for us, the question that we are certainly looking at ways in which we can address the group's losses, because we think it important. And again, we would look at it in terms of what is our cost structure, what are we doing, but that is not where your losses occur. What are the choices that we have, and we will be working on that, and we have put a team together to work on options. What we don't want to do is exercise options that add cost to the economy, because we can't take decisions around the policies we need to execute that are driven by whether it will cost us or increase our losses. We've got to do the right thing in our policy making. And therefore, part of that is, if we want to address, as we look at ways to address the question of loss taking, we need to bear in mind that we don't exercise policy choices around that are going to impact on the real economy. And the situation is likely to get worse, because if you look at it and the amount of losses we could incur in the current financial year and beyond, because of the changing yields on bonds, and that's what you have. So the losses there are likely to actually be bigger, but things outside your control. So we just alert members to that, to say that we would be looking at ways to offset losses, but not that would impact on the right policy decisions of the country. So what size we would have the contingency reserve, our own view would be build it up steadily, have it all, because you have the things comes in waves, and you will have prices, as we have had, which you are profit-making and loss-making. And as you know, when we are profitable, 90% of profits go straight to government. Mm-hmm. The other is part of what we use for our operating costs and building reserves and so on. So we do see this as a challenge going forward, but we are very mindful of it and looking at ways to address it that are least cost to the economy and do not impact on your policy-making, and that you don't do things you ought to do because they're going to incur losses. So I think that's just the context for that. But the actual size, the contingency reserve was about $12 billion, and we probably, and again, it's not something that you say in, you know, 1 year you've got to move that. When you're profitable, you'll start to build it up again. So it just creates a bit of a buffer. I would like to deal with the Twin Peaks issue on regulatory reform separately from the Ponzi scheme, because I think they're quite different issues. And perhaps when I ask colleagues to address that, it's very important. But again, I would say in relation to that, we're very happy to meet with you. I'm quite sure that the team working on the issues from our legal counsel and communication are very happy to meet with you on issues you've got around it. The best way to deal with the Ponzi schemes is to recognize that this is often driven by greed. And you can't account for the question of people, greed, and desire to have a quick response in terms of finances. And you've seen it with things like DefenseX and others, not just Chairmac. There's a range of And our annual report does cover that in terms of the number of schemes that we've been looking at. And as you're probably aware, or I hope you're aware, is that we have recently embarked on a communication campaign yet again on Ponzi schemes. But it is about something really just trying to get the South African public to be aware that if it sounds too good to be true, it usually is. So don't go there, because you're going to lose your money. And, you know, the expression is fools and their money are soon parted. Well, we don't want the South African public to be made to be foolish by people who have excessive greed and access. And the new technologies create opportunity for communication. And therefore, by the time you learn about it, it is already when the money has run out. That's why you heard about it, because people are not getting paid. But I've asked colleagues to deal with that. In terms of the question of the challenges we face about, you know, slowing growth and rising inflation, this is not common to us only. I mean, this is something that quite a number of emerging markets are facing. Very different to the advanced economies, because if you look at the United States, if you look at Japan, they're trying to get some inflation. Their concern is about deflation. They're trying to ensure that there's some inflation in the economy. So you've got very different policy challenges in the world at the moment, and quite a number of emerging markets are similar to us, rising inflation, slowing growth. Part of the challenge that you've got around it is a growth of 2% is simply not good enough. South Africa is part of the African continent, and certainly it's a growing region. We've got to look at the things that inhibit, and I think the growth issue and the confidence issue is very linked, and the investment at a domestic level. It's no good only talking about confidence from a global level. The question of domestic confidence is specifically important. And part of that relates to demand. You're not going to invest if you have excess capacity and are not aware of growing demand globally for your products. The opportunity to take advantage of a depreciated currency is therefore something that we are seeing some responses domestically to that. But this is an opportunity to really look at regaining some of the market share. And we are seeing some responses domestically. Again, our main trading partner still remains being the Eurozone. If it's not growing, if you've got questions of the Eurozone, as low growth as it is, the demand factor is not there. So it's an ugly question, or a difficult question that we all have to face in terms of that. In your question about energy, to me the question of energy is certainty. We've got to have a certain energy supply. The Eskom build has taken much longer than we expected and was hoped for. And the question is that if you don't have energy certainty about the supply, you can't, you know, Eskom said we haven't denied anybody access, but if you know that it isn't a supply, there are lots of projects that you don't go into. So there's no doubt for us that certainty of energy is critical. I can't comment on the nuclear issue because I think that is something still under discussion. But what I would like to say is that you've had very significant gas mines in Mozambique and in Namibia. And if you have the opportunity to look at a diversified approach to your energy mix, whether you're looking at renewables that we're looking at the moment, or Eskom and build, there's agreement to build another coal power station. Before we come to the nuclear issue, you've got two levers that service different parts of the economy or the country that you could look at that have very significant gas mines, as I said, Mozambique and Namibia. And the question for us is that's such an opportunity to look at a diversification. Mozambique certainly is looking at liquefying the gas and it's going straight on to container ships off to China, but it's on our doorstep. So I do think that the energy mix that we look at for country security of supply has great opportunities. And at different ways, because this is again part of your regional development, because energy is not just a South African issue. Angola certainly is looking at building new refineries and making opportunities in that way. So therefore, one could look at the range and certainness about looking at the shale gas option. See, the certainty of energy and the diversification of supply should give us the certainty and security that we require. One hopes that that's what is looked at. In terms of growth, again, we're seeing, and I come back to the region, not just domestically. One's confidence, but two, the region is growing. So while your manufactured exports into Europe may be slowing, and part of the discussion that is being held is how do we extend the AGOA agreement with the United States, the region and our exports into the region have grown significantly. And therefore, you are seeing a very rapid change in the diversification and being part of a regional growth story. So I think South Africa really could be a standout nation if we address the bigger picture issues ourselves around growth. There's no reason that we should be having a declining growth or declining exports at this point in time. And that again affects your current account deficit, which affects confidence, because the countries that have twin deficits, your fiscal deficits and your current account deficits, are seen as the most vulnerable. There's no reason for us to be, or there's no, but we certainly can address that issue ourselves. So in terms of productivity and labor and issues there, to me the question is, why are we so concerned? Why is it you're not getting your jobs? And if you have, our concern would be, if you have a question of settlement of wages that is not sustainable in the long term, unless matched by increased productivity, our concern is that your wage bill as a whole may not grow increase because you will have further job losses. And the move to mechanization, automation, technology is all developing anyway. This isn't simply a South African issue. If you look at your unemployment rate in Europe, which is now at about 12%, part of the challenge that you have there is that the nature of the jobs which are being created are such that it's unlikely to significantly enable new jobs to be created on the scale that you have. So unemployment may well become more structural. And you're seeing countries like Greece and Spain that have unemployment rates in excess of ours, both for across the board and for the EU. So I think that we need to be very mindful of the role of labor and the changing nature of technology that enables much greater automation and its impact with, as a country, we're concerned about the level of unemployment as a whole. So I think it's a very big challenge for all of us. Colleagues?
You covered it. Just to say that we would welcome a discussion on this property things. Bear in mind that what we regulate as the Reserve Bank is deposit-taking activities. And once we license this, our job is to protect the perimeter of deposit-taking. And once anyone who is not licensed to play in the deposit-taking perimeter gets into that perimeter, then we have to act. The problem with many of the schemes is that by the time you discover that people are doing that, it's so far down the line. And most of the time, it is because somebody has lost money that they end up reporting, or there had been a fallout among the operators of the scheme that you pick up this thing. And in the scheme that you had referred to, there are complex issues there, because there were the issues of deposit taking, which were illegal, but then there were also the conduct issues in the manner in which the schemes are put together. But this is a discussion that we would welcome. But the fact that we rely on the reporting before we can go and make the inspection, that affects the timing of when we actually intervene to establish what is legal and what is illegal in particular scheme.
Okay, Madamin.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you to the governor and team for coming and have such an informative presentation. Because without the presentation, Chair, we always look at the TV then and say, wow, that's where we are now. Having said that, then, Chair, I'm just passing. I heard you, Governor, saying when it comes to the foreign, I think it's the foreign reserve, where the IMF, actually, you are to be within a particular range. Where we are, as you have indicated earlier on, does it say to us we are sitting not comfortable with our foreign reserves? If so, so that we are aware that we are going to get another maybe downgrading from the IMF or whatever reporting from the IMF. And you also indicated that looking at the time that we are putting towards Christmas, because we are both using both policies, the monetary policy and the fiscal policy, does this mean we're going to see some more circulation of the money? If the answer is yes, what does that say to us? Because now we don't see the flows of the goods and services. Is it not going to affect again some economic stability? I'm not sure about that. So I just need a clarity anyway, Governor. Chair, I just have to go straight to Nadia, Nadia's presentation. Nadia, if you go to your report, I think it's page 88 in this report, this one. No, this one, not this one, part of it. Oh, it's not yours. Oh, I don't know who is it then. Now, you Chair, in this report, it talks about the national government financing and debt. Now, when you look at it, you try to analyze it, it gives some sort of panicking. I don't know what's the right word, or some sort of concerns, because there's so much of switch where the bank is switching the bonds this switching now, you are saying indeed the bank is trying to link it to the inflation. Now, the big question is, the remaining bonds that have been switched for long term, which is linked to inflation, for me it sounds more of a risk, but how then should we not able to achieve what we have planned towards those long term bonds? What happens, Governor? Because if you go down on the report, it indicates that all along we have been using we have been dealing with the domestic debt, but there's a plan from the Treasury that says they want to borrow something of 1.5 billion USD. Now, if that's where we are sitting with our current account, the deficit, and we go and borrow, that is now it's going to be a foreign exchange, and we are performing so badly with our exports, it leaves a very serious concern as to how then are we going to bridge what has been said by Brian, where he says he's perceiving a recovery to the inflation target that go back to what we spent. So if I can just get the clarity and be comfortable, because now if I look at that borrowing and I look at the switching of the bonds and the redeemed, and it is actually giving a serious concern to me. The other question, Chair, it goes to Brian, where he indicates that he looks at all the sectors and indeed looking at the mining, which we claim some industrial action that took place and some other factors that contributed towards that. But when you look at the iron ore, there was an increase in demand of the iron ore, okay, from China side. But South Africa failed to deliver, to reach the demand supply. It says in the report it was because we didn't have the skills. Now, Brian, it's a worry because you're talking about economic growth and you're talking about things that can manage as a country to make sure that we enhance the economic growth. There are other issues or factors which we cannot handle them because they're out of our control. They are in the global village and we can't control them. But issues where we're supposed to excel, like I am saying in iron ore, we're supposed to excel and cover the gaps which was created by the platinum, the depletion in the platinum and the depletion in the gold. We fail to do that. Now, what has the bank did? What has the bank done about that? We are in the almost on the fourth quarter, and this report is for March. What have we done about that? It's a serious concern. And the real wage increase that we are seeing, I think it was because of the unions failing to bargain, and the result they didn't have a choice. But having said that, we are also seeing some retrenchment, which is directly going to affect what you have mentioned to us, what savings. the savings and investment ratio, there's a huge gap. That gap is going to be even bigger. Because why? Because the investment expectation is not being met. Whether we're going to be able to meet those expectations, we don't know. I'm not too sure because of the poor confidence of what is happening. Now, how then can we try and moderate the household expenditure? Is it possible? Do we have another instrument to use? So that, because if we can try and improve the household expenditure, maybe we can try and see some savings going to the financial markets and see some improvement in the economic outlook. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Tim, I think you're the next, followed by Julian.
Thank you, Chair. Somebody in the delegation from the Reserve Bank commented to me that they haven't been to visit us because they haven't been invited. And I think that the quality of the presentation that we had today shows that even with our constrained program, we need to try and invite the Reserve Bank regularly, because it's very seldom that this committee actually engages with these really big issues facing our economy. And so far, it's been an incredibly interesting presentation. So thank you to the presenter. So I'll try and do it chronologically in terms of the presentation, starting with the annual report. I see on page 76 it says the salary increment was 7%. On page 65 it says the average remuneration cost went up by 8.4%. I presume the average remuneration cost includes the expansion of the headcount, but either way, even if it's 7, the Reserve Bank is responsible for holding us to an inflation target of 3 to 6%. What signal does it send to South Africa if the salaries in the Reserve Bank are increasing by above the inflation target range? I certainly, while the member parliaments in this term have not seen increases beyond the inflation target range, because the decision of the president is that it would send a poor signal to the country. Now, what does it say when the Reserve Bank salaries go up by beyond the target rate? That's a concern for me, Chair. Secondly, the governor spoke about our forex reserves perhaps being too low at $50 billion. What number, governor, would make you more comfortable? What range, perhaps? Then, Chair, we used to talk about the four pillars policy for banking in this country. It's not really in the narrative anymore, and I wonder, has there been a change? I mean, to some extent, we actually have five pillars now because Investec has just grown into one of the majors. Would you say, Governor, that the Reserve Bank has a five-pillar strategy now when it comes to banks, or would you be open to, as I would suggest, more competition from the banking sector? I'm not suggesting we should get to the Nigerian situation where there are hundreds of banks, but certainly I think more than five might be to the benefit of consumers without compromising stability. Then, Chair, the Governor spoke about the economic growth situation already and suggested that we weren't perhaps out of step with the rest of the emerging markets. But the truth is, I think we are. Governor, the IMF numbers yesterday said that we're currently 1% for this year below the world average. We're certainly below the emerging market average, and we're below the average growth in Africa. So by any of these counts, we're consistently growing slower than even other upper middle income countries. What is it? Why is there a growth constraint, a generalized growth constraint in South Africa relative to our peers? And then, Chair, in a related question, you asked me to dwell on the Article 4 report, so I'll just mention it briefly. But if you had to sum up that report, it says essentially the government has speed up the reform agenda. That's the one-line summary in my view. I'm sure you probably wouldn't think that was wildly wrong. And then, Governor, I think the line you used was we need to address, I think it was top-line issues, but you essentially echo that view, I think, that we need to accelerate the reform agenda. If I can challenge you to unpack that a little bit. What exactly How are we looking when it comes to that reform agenda, and what are the priorities, would you say? Chair, on the Twin Peaks presentation, it's very useful to get this presentation, particularly from the Reserve Bank, because I'm concerned that the legislative agenda of this committee hasn't taken into cognizance the views of the Reserve Bank on how Twin Peaks should work. We've had several public hearings on pieces of legislation from the Credit Rating Services Bill, the bill we're currently dealing with, the Financial Services Laws General Amendment Bill. And we often get this view from presenters that we're putting the cart before the horse, that we should perhaps get Twin Peaks done before we start legislating in these important areas. And the one particular problem, Deputy Governor, I'd like to know if you agree with that sentiment. I mean, are you satisfied that Parliament and this committee has not put a cart before the horse when it comes to financial legislation and sequencing with Twin Peaks, in particular the Financial Markets Bill? Now, you mentioned, Deputy Governor, over the counter derivatives. We assigned several very important policy decisions for OTC derivatives to the FSB. Now, in line with what you've fetched out today with the two different mandates being the two peaks, to me, the FSB is meant to be handling market conduct, but certainly when it comes to those OCD derivatives, we've given them some responsibilities. We've expanded the FSB's mandate with that bill ahead of 20s. But someone off the record said to me, well, this is a pure power play by the FSB to try and shore up their position ahead of Twin Peaks, as if it's some kind of competition. Now, that's probably a little bit of a radical statement, but it does raise concerns. Because we've had the FSB here often lobbying for all sorts of things in these laws, and this is the first time we've seen the Reserve Bank on Twin Peaks. And then my third question on that to the Deputy Governor. I've been a bit of a stuck record with the Deputy Director General on when we do financial regulation, if we focus more on the power of competition to achieve the ends rather than interventionist regulation, if you will. And I think we under-emphasize competition in all the bills we've passed so far, and indeed we're doing it again in the Financial Services Laws General Amendment Bill, in my view. I'd like to hear your thoughts on the role of competition in regulating the financial markets. Chair, it's challenging to deal with the economic report, which is really excellent, but it doesn't have page numbers. So I'm going to, I only really want to refer to three graphs. The first one is the one that shows the delinking, Brian, between South African currencies and peer emerging market currencies. That happened towards the end of 2012, it lasted until the middle of this year. And then there was, as you say, a couple. We're now tracking the other emerging markets again. Now, to me, if I look at that time period, that was about, it was about Americana, actually. It was about international sentiment about Americana, and perhaps the ratings downgrade as a secondary issue. Now, we Americana was an industrial action issue. We're now back in that movie. We're seeing above inflation wage increases. We're seeing this alarming effect on investment, with BMW being the case that everyone's talking about right now. This is a tough one. What is the solution? How do we avoid this annual descent into economic lockdown on the back of our industrial relations? Then, Governor, the tapering issue. Obviously, we saw what happened when there was a threat of tapering and the rand depreciated. Now that depreciation, I'm not going to talk about how various ministers might have responded to it, but broadly, a depreciation would have two effects. It would enhance the competitiveness of exports, and it would eventually lead to imported inflation. So a very positive effect and a negative effect, especially from the use of it. Which effect is stronger in South Africa currently? Then, on the current account deficit, there's a slide, Brian, again, I don't know which one it is, import volumes outperforming export volumes. But what happened in the early 2000s is essentially we started importing more than we export. And I would argue, I think you might agree, that that's about problems in South African manufacturing. But I think the Governor referenced how we're part of this continent that's increasingly buying manufactured goods. But we're not taking advantage of that. We've experienced this shift in our import-export performance. What do we need to do to stop benefiting from the market for our manufactured goods on the rest of the continent, stop supplying that market? Just three or four more, Chair. I'll keep it very, very brief. The governor in June was quoted on issues around the youth wage subsidy, saying that it's possible to incentivize firms to hire young people while protecting the existing workforce and addressing unemployment. Well, that's certainly the view of our party. We supported this kind of idea 3 years ago when it was first tabled. But my concern is that over the last 3 years, we've neither implemented a regime to incentivize the employment of young people, nor have we done anything else. The labor market has been no reform in the past 3 years. So it's not actually a question of whether we think the youth wage subsidy is a good idea versus some other model that's on the table. It's actually a problem of leadership, I guess. We've done nothing. How do you resolve that? Because it's not a policy decision now. It's about being able to choose a path and follow it. On unsecured lending, which is less in the headlines now than it was, Chair, but in the report it shows that for the year to December 2012, there was an increase from 321 billion to 441 billion, a significant increase in unsecured lending. I was quite alarmed at the headline in Linda's paper. Well, it wasn't a headline, it was an article headline in Linda's paper yesterday where one of the banks was quoted as saying unsecured loans help keep heads above water. That's an extremely dangerous sentiment. Despite the fact that the public's attention is not on it to the extent that it was a few months ago, when is enough enough? What level of unsecured lending would require a change in acting from you relative to that 441 billion figure? Chair, if I can just end quickly with a point which wasn't covered, but which I'm increasingly hearing representation from, particularly from people involved in the technology sector, particularly for venture capitalists, that there are major, major concerns with our exchange control regime. The real issue around the Shuttleworth judgment, I know he didn't get his money back and I didn't expect him to, but the real issue there is that the court has asked the Treasury and the Reserve Bank to go back and fix provisions of the Exxon regulations that are not constitutional. Now, Chair, you know my view on this. There's only about 30 countries in the world that have exchange control regulations, including Burma, North Korea, Venezuela, Libya, Cuba, Zimbabwe. This is not a neighborhood that we should be in, given the confidence that you yourself, Governor, said we should have in our economy. Our exchange control is not a vote of no confidence in our economy by our government. And I know you've been on record, or the Reserve Bank rather, in their submission to that case, has been on record saying that exchange control protected us from the global financial crisis. But I think there's some consensus in some quarters that isn't the case, and that the regulation around banking in particular was the actual reason why we dodged that. So certainly countries like Australia and Canada also weren't affected by the first round effect. They don't have exchange control. The position used to be a scrapping of exchange controls over the long term. What is it now?
It was a submission. It was a submission, and I know Tim here nothing is an opportunity like this. But I think we should allow your team to respond, but also just to remind Honorable Harris that on the youth tax incentives, we've got public hearing next week. The National Treasurer will also have the opportunity to kind of respond to most of the issues that we've raised. They may not necessarily be resident with the Reserve Bank. So I just wanted to remind you that there's a process that is going to deal with that particular matter. Thanks. No. You are not. It's you and Madams. So let's take this. The responses, and then thereafter we'll take just the last round. Okay.
Thank you very much. My colleagues will obviously add as well, but I'd like to start with Marlene and the honourable member. I think that in terms of your discussions on reserves, Just to draw the distinction between the contingency reserve, which is what we build up to work in a bank and act as a buffer, and the reserves of the country. The reserves of the country stand at about $50 billion gross reserves at the moment. And the IMF report, it says quite clearly they think that we should build up more reserves. We're within the measure that they use, but it's at the low end, as I gave with different examples. And what it is that in our view, we would not disagree, and I don't think there is an ideal limit or an ideal parameter that you would say, we have reserves of this, we're okay. To just give an example, the Brazilians at the moment, as I said, they have just under $400 billion, and in terms of the impact on the currency and the depreciation, they took a decision that they would spend over the next few short period $60 billion, and it made no difference whatsoever. Okay. And part of the challenge then is what is an ideal level? If you look at, say, the U.S., they have a reserve currency that they don't need. If you look at some of the advanced economies, they don't have much more. I think it needs to be, as part of the global discussions, what is happening around the buildup of the reserve, because it's hugely costly for countries. And if you look at China, as I said, they've got $3.5 trillion in reserves. It might be a cost on the economy as well, but it's part of the balancing in terms of what is happening to you. When you build up reserves, you're usually building up when your currency is appreciating. It's very difficult to build reserves when your currency is depreciating because of costs involved and you're feeding into a depreciation which would make it even worse. So it's a complex issue and I don't think that there is an ideal limit or an ideal amount. Okay, if you have this amount, you're then comfortable. It's what can you do with those reserves and what does it mean? And right now, it's a question of huge costs. To countries to hold these levels of reserves. So my suggestion in terms of the global discussion is that the levels of reserves should be considered as part and parcel. Is this the only way to give yourself buffer and resource to act in protection of your currency? So it's a difficult question. The question of the circulation of the increase in notes, I think the different issues here, the increase of circulation, as I said, we grow at about 10% per annum. And it does mean that when we come into December, we're going to have more notes available because people use cash much more over a holiday period like December. So yes, circulation in notes, I don't think it relates to the other issues that you were raising. I think circulation in and of itself is the means by which we have confidence in our currency and that we use it as cash. The idea was, if you thought about it a few years ago, is that there'd be greater moves to plastic, there'd be much greater moves to a reduction in cash, and the use of cash in economies, we're not seeing that. We're notwithstanding the increase in the use of cards in four different forms, but it is not showing a decrease in the use of notes and coins. In terms of the household expenditure moderating, well, that relates, as Brian pointed out, you've got a debt to disposable income that is fairly steady, but you are seeing that households are under pressure by a whole range of issues. You know, the level of indebtedness is one thing, but the cost that people are experiencing, which is the direct impact on them, whether it is electricity or water or education and healthcare, all of these costs are rising. But the most immediate transmission to people is the cost of petrol. And that's where your exchange rate comes in, because you can see if you've got a depreciating currency and the currency costs the oil price is globally rising. So the cost of that, we're seeing that if you look at the price of petrol, it's impacted directly, and that goes through on a monthly basis to individuals. So it's a very serious impact, not just on the cost of the individual, but also on the cost of transport, so therefore it has a further effect on the cost of things that require to be transported. So food, for instance, is one, is that you find transport costs impact on your cost of food and availability. So in that sense, I think that household expenditure moderating is because people are under pressure. Now, what can one do about it? I think that we really would urge everybody, especially coming to Christmas, try to manage your debt down, don't get into debt, look at the cost of debt, try to see that you are able to service the debt that you go into, and recognize that whatever your capital expenditure is, whether you are looking at housing or motor vehicle or whatever, that interest rates don't stay at these levels. At some point in time, it turns. And therefore, you've got to be able to plan for a long-term investment that interest rate isn't always as low as it is now. So your cost of borrowing needs to be looked at. So I think that those are some of the measures. And to me, the more informed the public is about what the real costs are, or the cost if you buy, you know, in terms of lay-bys and in terms of paying over a period of time, and the actual cost of the product. And that would in itself, if we have a more informed public, would help create, I think, and generate savings, because the cost of the item that you buy and you're able to pay for it, as to, the difference is if you pay over 6 months, a year, 18 months, the cost of that item is very, very different. And therefore, that disclosure becomes extremely important when people are buying. So I think everyone needs to be aware of these pressures. And then, in the end, it relates to the level of employment. Because if one of the risks people have, and one of the risks that in terms of the banking sector, as it is, and certainly what we would be concerned about, is if you have, if you don't have new people coming into the market, or you have people who lose their jobs, then of course the question of indebtedness increases because you haven't got a certainty of income. So for me, protection of the jobs we've got and enhancing job creation is critically important to addressing these issues that tackle these people. On the question of the annual report and the salary increases above inflation, look, we can only agree with you that this is, and again, it's a negotiated question, and we made it very clear that we are moving to a significant proportion of increase for staff that is performance-related and that which is across the board. So that we are wanting to link much more to performance and to be within the target range. We've certainly felt that we need to deal with this by example, and both and the executive members and the board took no increases this year at all and have kept all of our increases within the upper range of the target. So it is something that we think is extremely important, and we've made it clear to staff that this is part of, you see, part of the question here of this is we were changing the 12-month to a 15-month, which is where the increase actually occurred in this way, because in terms of moving to performance, we needed to have a period of time after the close of the financial year to do the performance evaluations and let that feed into the salary. So if you can't do it, we didn't want to do it for space. So we were moving from end of April to beginning of July. And therefore, it's the extra 3 months that's related to this increase being above what we would have liked. But it was part of moving it into the performance range. So going forward, it will be 12 months July to July, but allowing that 3 month window for us to ensure that we've done all the performance evaluations for the annual. So it was a bit of a difficult year in that sense. But certainly the point's well taken, and we certainly are committed to that as the executive in the bank. In terms of forex quantums, I think I've addressed that. I don't think there's an ideal or an absolute amount. The question is whether you're perceived to be vulnerable, and the IMF has made it very clear. We don't necessarily agree with that approach. That they think we should make a pre-analysis is what we're going to buy. And as we said, it's not a level that aiming, it's sort of the cost. These are real costs. These are not sort of book entry. So we're not quite in agreement with that. Obviously, we do feel we would like more reserves, but it's the way you get there and the cost involved in that. In terms of banks and the four-pillar policy, there's no doubt that all of us in the bank agree that we need greater competition. The question is, where does that competition come from? If you look at the investment corporate banking sites, that's very vigorous competition because you've got all the international players here. So on that side of it, there's a very vigorous competitive environment. On the retail side, you're not seeing the same competitiveness from external because they find that our banks are very well covered and highly organized and competitive. So they don't see themselves being able to play in that retail space. I think there is competition between the banks, but if you look at it, what our approach has been is to look at different requirements. So we've been trying to encourage, and obviously a lot of the policy issue relates to the Treasury rather than ourselves, but we would say we've looked at whether you don't have dedicated banks, cooperative banks, things that operate at a lower level in terms of the engagement at a grassroots level, if you like. That limits the risk. The Post Bank itself, obviously, is meeting certain requirements, and it has to ensure that we don't have Post Office and Post Bank interchangeable. But the Post Bank itself should play a critical role in, because what you want is financial inclusion. You want access to finance that's affordable. So yes, we would agree with that. But I think that you need to be looking at it much more from our side. The question would be, can we have a differentiated approach that would enable a different capital requirement if you don't take certain risks. But once you are dealing with a full gamut of banking services, then you've got to meet all the requirements. There can't be exceptions. Because you're dealing with other people's money, which is the public. So yes, greater competition. As I said, I don't think that affects investment banking, corporate banking side. On the retail side, much greater disclosure, the question of how your cost and fee structures are there, and whether you can introduce different layers of banks. And I mean, cooperative banking is, we've got quite a few applications in the pipeline, a couple that are being approved. But this is something that you have to generate from the ground. You can't impose and say, well, you will have a cooperative bank. It's got to be a group of people who come together. And I think our approach is to be as enabling as possible, because we're trying to see greater competition. And that also relates to greater disclosure and information. So people have choices, and the ease of changing between banks and so on becomes important. So disclosure is a critical part of that. If we have to look at the question of, I think you'll deal with the Twin Peaks and the legislative frame and the other issues there. Solution to industrial relations. You've got to talk to each other. And I think that applies as much to labor as it does to employer. That's the heart of the question. If you do not have a labor force that understands the business that you're doing in your company, in your sector, in the global environment, you're not going to have a labor force that is really aware of what all of this entails. And I'll tell you, I mean, one of our concerns is that the interaction between employer and employee has certain parameters that is not in the best interest of either. And I'll give you an example of when we've been discussing this with some of the employers, particularly in the mining sector, that one of them gave. It said they were trying to understand these dynamics better and went down the mine and to the coal face, and it's a platinum mine. And they were talking to the people at the coal face, platinum face, and saying, you know, what is it that you're digging out here? And they did not know. They did not know. The workforce digging out the mine did not know what that product was. They didn't know when they got it out or what it was used for. Now, if you have a workforce that is not, and I'm using mining as an example because it's in the cutting edge, it varies with different industries. It varies with different sectors. In the financial sector, you'll have a much more sort of, you've got a population that understands the financials. If you've got a workforce, whether it's agriculture or mining or automotive, you need to have an informed workforce that understands what is happening in that company, what are your plans, what are your financials, what are the threats, what are the risks, and to have that active engagement. You need to have an informed workforce. You need to have engaged workforce. So it will be different in different sectors and in different companies within that. But generally speaking, labor relations in this country are not good. And that isn't only about labor, it is also about employment. And that is a challenge that we have to face. Sit down and talk to each other. And, you know, the question of whether you go on strike, it should be a last resort. It can't be because you have a right to strike doesn't mean you have a duty to strike. Okay. But coming to those settlements and those issues means that employers also need to understand the conditions. And I'm not saying they're all the same. They're not. But generally speaking, if we look at the ways that are happening here, and part of it is, and I think that's very important, is that you have multi-year deals, which you have got these conclusions now. But you've got it. Whether you've come to a solution, you still need to address the relationship and the recognition of what is driving some of these issues. And that's about how we talk to each other as well. So I think it's not a simple issue. This is very difficult. But we need to find ways of going into that kind of engagement that recognizes the role and the respect of the obligations that we all have and difficulties that we all have. When we talk about papering, I think your question there was a depreciating imported inflation as well as greater market access. They're not either or. The question that you have is that, and let's look at depreciation as distinct from the talk of papering. If you're looking at a depreciating currency, you need to have a consistency. Our problem is not just the depreciation, it's the volatility. So that you've got to be able to look forward and say, within the band, this is what will happen. Now, there are real opportunities for that to take place now in terms of the depreciation. But our corporates have to be responsive to that, and I think that that is always a little bit of testing the waters, how long does it stay because of the volatility. But there are real opportunities to be taken now, and as I said earlier, it then depends on whether there is actually market and whether there's demand. Now, you know, your point, Honourable Member, was a question that you didn't think that our corporates were taking advantage sufficiently of the growth in the region. And I think it would range in a number of ways. If you looked at manufactured goods, I think they have. We've grown from about 22-23% to about 38% now of our manufactured goods. So that's in a very short period of time. That's a huge change. What will enhance that is what infrastructure exists. And that's the challenge for the sub-Saharan region. And that, if you look at the SADC initiatives, they focused on what do we need to do about infrastructure, road, rail, transport, water, electricity. And that's why these energy fines that we have are so important, because they can alter the economic efficiencies of what we can do. So if we want to expand on that in the way we do, it's got to be a combined effort. And just to give perhaps a little bit of a different angle to it in terms of what the bank is able to do, because again, in these things, the bank has a different role from your trade and from your finance. The bank has worked for a number of years now in creating common payment systems. And because if you want to have trade, you've got to be able to pay. So we now have real-time gross settlements, which is available in a CMA. It's gone live. It went live in July. And that is now open to other SADC members who are looking at the ability to do it. If you have your payment systems that are common, that are functional, it's going to make a huge difference to the opportunity. And that's been a very sterling work done by a collective of the central bank. It's not just ourselves. It's the central banks working together to get this payment system. The other area that we've been working on very diligently is the question of harmonization of data and the integrity of data, so that we're looking at common objectives, certainly in the SADC region, in terms of what is your deficit target, inflation target, debt levels to GDP, etc. And there's a work that is done on a quarterly basis that we work together on to say what is moving, how is this coming together. And it's actually a very important initiative on data collection, data dissemination. And then we work together also on the question of financial markets and on the banking sector. So there's common regulation and how it applies in the region. So we're trying to create a framework, the infrastructure in the region that makes other things possible. And the Committee of Central Bank Governors meets on a regular basis for the SADC country to get reports, to assess, and to see how this can work, including meeting with the SADC Secretariat on how the other initiatives are working and whether there's a more to play. Unsecured lending. I think the question with unsecured lending is something that it's what more can we do? Don't forget that we have been very active in this, in that the Bank Supervision Department, in its engagement with the boards and the CEOs of all our banks, has for the past year been discussing this issue with them and expectations of how this is working. But when we talk about unsecured lending, you need to differentiate a little bit. And it's coming down very fast over this recent period, I think, as Brian indicated. But you need to also recognize that your credit card is unsecured lending. If you go to a rural area where there isn't a bank, you only have access to build your house to unsecured lending. So you don't want to look at it as growing exponentially and the kind of loan sharking that is there. But you do want to ensure that financial inclusion has been really significant. If you look at between Able and Capitec, which are our two banks that focus on unsecured lending, you have over 8 million people who are clients to those two banks. That is huge. If you then want to look at it and say unsecured lending is bad, you've had financial inclusion for 8 million people. So it's how you manage it. What are the rates? Is it ethical? Look at your product. So there's a lot of work to be done there. But I think giving it simply a bad aim and thinking it is bad per se is not going to address the question of financial inclusion. Does it need a sound framework? Absolutely. Does it need to be looked at on a consistent? And your big banks are going into this. So the clients are much more than your 8 million. That is very significant in terms of moving people out of poverty. And that relates to whether the lending is appropriate, ethical, all the kinds of things that you want to ensure is in place. Because what is the option that people have? And I'm not saying that that's the only option. But if you've got a credit record, and that comes back to this discussion about writing out credit records, but if you've got a credit record, you're a client that has a consistent ability to pay, you've got to move out of the sort of lower end, the high risk unsecured lender, into having a client with a credit record that can get access to finance at a cheaper rate. And that's part of building your credit record. So to me, unsecured lending is about ethical behavior and the role of regulators in that regard. And the question of course, in the end, also has to be about individuals and their behavior, because we don't want an indebted population. But that relates to the information that we provide. All I'm pointing out here is that financial inclusion is certainly a target and a goal of government, and the banking sector needs to ensure, the regulators need to ensure, that it's done ethically and fairly, and that we don't add to the problem. But in the end, you can't solve people's over-indebtedness if they are determined to spend, which they haven't got. You've got to look at ways in which you try to manage that better. But has this addressed a huge need in our society? I think it has. So does it need balance? Absolutely. Does it need sound regulation? Absolutely. Does it need an informed plan? Absolutely. And I think that's the most important question. The affordability, and part of that comes back to what kind of lifestyle we all would like to support. So an informed public is absolutely critical to sound regulation. I'm not sure if I left others out, but I think that I've probably covered Pangani and then Malaysia.
No, Governor, I just wanted to, in terms of Madlamin's question, relating to the issue of the increase in currency and coins in circulation, the 110 billion that the governor spoke about. One of the things that we need to take into account is that number is a number that is taken at a moment in time, particularly around December, that when we reach those levels. And why do we reach those levels? It's really the issue around the free movement of people. You will know that the rent circulate freely in the countries neighboring us. So you have the CMA, which is Swaziland, Lesotho, and Namibia, where the rent officially circulate. But you as well have Namibia, Botswana, Zimbabwe, Mozambique, and Angola, northern part of Angola, where the rent does circulate freely. So around December, a lot of people go home and they withdraw money and they go with it. And then we do get back through the normal channel for repatriation. So around about that time, the level of the money in circulation does increase because of this movement that we're referring to.
Thanks, Governor. Since there was a question raised by Honorable Dubazan regarding the switching of bonds by the bank, let me state upfront that that's the preserve of the Treasury. The bank acts as an agent of the Treasury in administering the auctions. What the report also states is that the switching takes place precisely to minimize the risk. The biggest risk that a debt manager faces is refinancing risk. It is that risk that one day your debt is falling due and you try to roll it over and you find you can't roll it over. What the switch options do is that they offer the debt manager an opportunity to switch the bond from a shorter dated bond to longer dated bonds before the maturity arrives. Because if you wait for that day, and that day comes, and you find that you can't raise the money, you are in all sorts of trouble. So that is why the switch options then that the Reserve Bank administers on behalf of the Treasury are done way before the maturity, precisely so that you minimize that risk. There was also a question that you raised that said that, well, why are you borrowing in foreign currency when your exports are falling? How are you going to pay that in the future? Again, I will answer in general terms because debt management policy is the stuff I used to do. I don't want to rule from the grave. To say that for a sovereign, your biggest asset is not the money in the bank. It's your ability to collect taxes in the future, which is why you would find that most governments, including in South Africa, would choose to borrow the bulk of their financing in their domestic currency, because you know that the taxes you're going to collect in the future are in the domestic currency rather than in foreign currency. It is for that reason that you would find that even in the critique, whether it's the IMF or the rating agencies, the one thing they state is that South Africa's level of foreign currency denominated debt is small. Even to the extent that there are foreigners active in our domestic market, they are active in our domestic currency debt, which means that the risk to us is actually minimal. So the idea of borrowing offshore, keep it small because you don't collect taxes in foreign currency, you collect them in domestic currency, and it was meant to mitigate that. That is why you see it being kept that low. The Honorable Harris, the question about whether Parliament is putting the cart before the horse. No, I don't think you are. Part of the problem is that you are in a way trying to fix an aircraft that is in flight. We are busy with the domestic reform agenda to create the Twin Peak money. We meet in the G20, and our leaders make commitments in the G20, all the global leaders, and they say that there shall be central counterparties come the 1st of January. All over-the-counter derivatives shall be cleared through central counterparties come the 1st of January. We can't meet those international obligations because we are still busy designing our architecture. That is why you saw the Treasury and the FSB. They did consult us, saying that there are particular aspects of the international reform agenda that we are going to have to deal with now. Is the FSB positioning itself? Definitely not. In the discussions that we've had, and in the implementation document that was published in January, the supervision of this significant financial market infrastructure are captured in that document as they would be moved over to the South African Reserve Bank. So you can relax because it is captured in that document. Is this ideal that these things are being done? Not ideal, but as I said, we have got international obligations. And the only way in which we could do something in the meantime was through the amendments to these pieces of legislation that you have seen. Competition in the financial markets, I think Ravana captured it in the banking sector. The South African financial markets themselves, not just the sector, the financial markets are very competitive. It's something that we forget in South Africa, that when the World Economic Forum released its World Competitiveness Report, we all focused on, our labor is uncompetitive, our education is uncompetitive. What we didn't say is that South Africa was number one in the regulation of its financial market. South Africa was number one in the regulation of its accounting and auditing profession. We were number two in the regulation of the banking system and the quality of our banking system. So there are lots of positives, and all of that bear testimony to the importance of competition in our financial markets. For us to be rated that way is testimony to that. Competition is important because it is the only way in which you are able to discourage bad behavior. There are some sectors in our industry which have fallen victim to the competition commission because they undermined the importance of competition in the sectors that they were operating. Exchange control and the impact on it. Are we still on course that we are gradually removing these things? Yes, we are. But as we reflect, we must also bear in mind, because you mentioned a lot of horrible countries. There are other less horrible countries like Brazil and those that are living. But interestingly, there are things that we had in our exchange control regulations which are not exchange control. I mean, I got a shocker in my previous job that I found that if you were a municipality and you wanted to borrow in the domestic market, you needed exchange control approval. And I looked at this and I said, what does this thing do in exchange control? The reason was not hard to find. There was no framework to govern the borrowing activities of municipalities. And when the Municipal Finance Management Act came into being, that stuff was migrated out of exchange control. So there are important things that are in those regulations which might not belong there. They belong in the space of prudential tool and prudential management. Suffice to say the following, though, that when we started the process to gradually liberalize exchange control regulation, the IMF said to us we must go for a big bang. That was in 1996. In 1998, the same IMF came to us and said you are moving too fast. In 2010, the same IMF came back and said, do you know what? We actually think there are merits in you having a little bit of exchange control, and they started advising other countries and say you can have some of these things. One of these days when you are with the chair, ask him to tell you the story of Mateja Gwoje. Bottom line was that we decided to protect the integrity of domestic policy formulation and stayed the course that we have set for ourselves. Yes, there are regulations that the court said that are unconstitutional and we must change. We have been given 18 months to effect the changes, and we will do that. What is important in that ruling is that the act has not been ruled unconstitutional, and neither were the entirety of the regulations ruled unconstitutional. There were particular aspects that were ruled unconstitutional.
Can you take the last two questions? I know we'd love to have more time, but unfortunately we have to round off. Judith?
Thanks, sir. I think the disadvantage being the last person, or almost the last person, is that most of things have been covered and others have been given. But also let me congratulate the Real Estate Bank and keeping us on the outlook and ensuring that there's stability in the country. The issue of the upside risk around the issue of inflation, it's important in terms of the outlook. It requires that we need to monitor it. The question therefore becomes, should the risk to medium inflation outlook deteriorate significantly? Therefore, what becomes the appropriate action to be taken in order to maintain the integrity of the inflation, but to also ensure that it doesn't affect, you know, the workers, the poor, and so forth? That is my question around the issue of inflation. On the economic, you know, development, I think it's a huge document. It's quite intense, and in fact, it's quite engaging. It's quite important for us to get into it. The reality is that Reserve Bank, Governor, you know, it is quite worrisome, the issue of unemployment, specifically on the youth sector. And, you know, as much as the country, and we develop statistics and all that, then we're just saying 70% unemployment. It's almost as if we're speaking about something that, you know, we are living with it. And we understand it's a global issue, it's not only us that we're facing it. However, we still need to have measures and remedies to deal with the issue. It cannot be correct that we keep on, you know, talking about it almost as if it's just something that is there on paper and this is what is happening. Our economic development or other growth, it is important that we need to arrive at that 5%. However, we're sitting at 2%. It's not, it doesn't look projected at this point and realistic that we'll arrive there. You know, the discussion around the subsidies, I mean, we had a discussion on the incentives and the issue, a discussion now that's seated on the youth accord. I mean, we need a lot of measures to devise to be able to deal with the issue of unemployment. It cannot be around just one issue. However, all I'm saying is that I think that it's important that as much as we might have, you know, issues like your NDPs and all that, the reality on the investor confidence relies on the issue around, you know, our ability of the policy to ensure that our policy is stable and we don't have uncertainties around the policy direction, therefore, that we are taking. Because I think that is some part of the impediment for us to deal with this youth issue that we are talking about. So I think that it's something that we need at a political level that we need to manage. But 2%, yeah, it's quite worrisome. The question is, another question is on the impact of globalization in the South African economy. If you can share your thoughts around it for more sitting. The employment on private sector, and I think that it cannot be correct where we are sitting today. We keep on saying the issue of business. It is important for business to invest. It's important for business to be able to employ. However, we have seen that it is public sector that is coming on. But we cannot have an economy and sustain it if we have an economy where public sector is the biggest employer. I mean, now really. And as much as the social, the partners that we're discussing and all that, where we've got that observation, I think where we are sitting, it is not correct, and there needs to be a line, a thin line. I mean, business is about risk. Business will invest, business will employ people or will take risk at a point where they feel that there is profit. And the reality of the situation where we are sitting, we are quite weak. However, we cannot have a trajectory for the public being the biggest employer and the private sector just clearly sitting there waiting for things to look better, therefore they come into the country and they invest. So they need to be a radical approach around it and pushing business to come into play into the sector, because it's not assisting our economy where we are sitting. I want to speak about the issue of, for instance, the investment that we keep on talking about. And we've seen the issue of Sandra, that we needed, you know, at this point, I need to have your thoughts, Governor, where we are sitting in terms of the confidence we're speaking about and the investment we're speaking about into our own country. I mean, I feel on the Sandra issue, a government needed to keep the end of their bargain as far as the method of payment, therefore, that will do, because they got savings, and I mean, government must be able to keep the end of the bargain around it. But the question is that what there becomes this impact in delivering on the issue, because it's taken long, and the more, you know, we stand in law, now you've got, of course, social groupings and contesting and all that. But what becomes the outlook when they're looked at? Because we should be able to pay or rather keep the end of our bargain as far as our investment strategy continues. So I'm saying that, therefore, how does this impact us globally in terms of the outlook around us being able to, I mean, be honest about the contracts that we enter into? Governor spoke about taking advantage of the depreciated currency, and you spoke, I think, I mean, and they're comfortable in terms of the issue of sub-Saharan and how they take advantage of it. However, the issue of balancing the trade and the issue of the exporting facility, I think it's quite important. It depends how you look at it, and it also depends, therefore, what becomes the timing. It is quite sad that, I mean, you don't wait for markets to come up and down. They don't even tell you. You just see things happening. That is the economics. However, don't we think, Governor, probably for us to be able to encourage, especially in the infrastructure rollout, because that's where my interest is at, around us being able to, you know, deal with the issue of export, but also the importing facility, that at this time of the equation where we are sitting, this is the time for us as department and all that to be able to get into the importing and able to buy things at them and taking advantage of the depreciate the currency. I'm just saying in terms of the infrastructure, the timing of it, probably something that we need to look into. However, thank you so much for the presentation. Thanks, Chair.
Madam.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would like to pose my questions in Afrikaans, please, if it's possible. Chairperson, myself and my family wrote examinations 2 weeks ago. And I said to her at the beginning of the session, we should have had this session before we wrote the examination. It was very, very informative. Thank you. Okay, but mine is on the annual report, and it's on page 144 and 145. And now I'll start in Afrikaans. Ons gaan op plaas 144 word daar onder meer gepraat van die Suid-Afrikaanse munt koöperasie, waar daar ongelukkige voorval was van munte wat nie op standaard was nie. En daar gesê boe aan plaas 145, daar seker maatregels getref. So graag weet wat die maatregels is getref en is daar een regstelling al daarvan. En dan het die governor gesê in haar beslag dat oor die piramideskemas, ons weet baie ou mense is die slagoffers van piramideskemas. En dat daar sekere maatregels getref word om dit te voorkom. Nou, Governor, ek is gebore in die BBT, dit staan Born Before Technology. Het die Reservebank al daaraan gedink om technologie aan te wend, om mense te waarsku teen piramideskemas? Ek weet, ek gepraat van die idee dat hulle ontdek, dit is bezig om te gebeur, daar is het al amper te laat. Maar jy weet, ons wat oefal die, service providers, wat vir ons sê, die toeveel duisend rand gewen, en so, kan die reservebankie daar aan dink, om mense ook deur middel van technologie, smartphones en support te waarsku teen die soort goed, want vir my, ek is al 'n wyser, vir my is dit 'n soort van opvoeding, finansiële opvoeding, wat ons aan die gemeenskap gee. My vraag rondom die contingency reserve is beantwoord, Chairperson, baie dankie.
What I can just inform you, Governor, is that Honorable Adam says he was born before technology.
I think I will deal with the permitting. Unfortunately, I need to reply in English, so I can understand you, but my Afrikaans is pretty poor. In terms of your point, this is from the minutes of the AGM that you're drawing from on the Mint. And it had, I mean, there's not much more to add other than it come to our attention that in some of the coins there had been not quite the level of gold that was meant to be there. The public was informed, those people who had the coin, very small number, and what we looked at was the processes in the mint to ensure that this could not or should not happen. So that matter, I think, has been addressed. It was obviously a great concern to us. But as we said, we did notify those people who were affected and advise accordingly it hadn't. It's an issue that was then dealt with at that time. So I don't think there's more to add to that, but obviously what we continue to do and continuously do this is add to the question of ensuring that the processes and the oversight are vigorously looked at both at the moment and at the same time. Let me come back to Honourable Member Kavalala. A lot of the things that you've said are really your statements rather than something that I can respond to directly because you know, a lot of them relate to the wider issues than the central bank. So I'll deal with a couple of the things that you have certainly in terms of if you took Sunwell and the commitment. One can have a discussion about whether this was the best way to do it or not. I'm not an expert on that at all. What you have to have is certainty. If you've got an agreement, that you have an international obligation and that you have a contract, you've got to meet them. It's a discussion Obama is trying to have with the Congress at the moment is you cannot, the U.S. cannot default, which would be the first time in their history, you've got obligations, and you meet them. If you have issues you need to address and sort them out, that's a different question. And I think that OTAN has just lost the court case again. In terms of exports, imports, and the question of depreciation, the challenge that you've got with depreciation is that, for instance, and I think I would use the petrol price as an example, which is something that's adjusted monthly, and depending on what the recovery rate is and what the cost is, you have an immediate see-through into real economy through the cost that people pay for petrol. And if you have a depreciating currency, and that's why when there was a lot of talk about the challenges when we had an appreciating currency, we said at the time was to take advantage of the appreciation for the capital imports that you're going to make. Because you do have an advantage when you have a strong exchange rate. The question we've got with the imports is that a significant amount of our imports relates to the capital spend on the infrastructure that government is committed to undertaking. Now, that's, you know, whether how they finance that, how they've hedged, that is something they're familiar with. But the challenge you've got in a depreciating currency is it makes those imports more expensive. And therefore, as I said, depending on what they've done to mitigate that risk, but in the end, your infrastructure spend is about improving your economic efficiencies over time. And that's why if you looked at the slide that, if you remember the slide that Brian put up, it was not as much the increased imports as the declining exports that's had the impact on our current account. Now, the declining exports isn't that we haven't got them to export. It's that we haven't got them to the market. And that is something that only we can resolve as a country and in our working relations and so on, is to say, take advantage, you've got a depreciating currency, you can get into markets that you couldn't have before, but get the goods out. So that's part of our challenge. If you look at the motor industry, they're very clear that they operate at virtually full capacity, and therefore over the weeks of the strike, they have not produced motor vehicles, and therefore that production is lost. You don't make it up. So those are the challenges that I think we've got on exports and imports. In terms of employment and the challenge to the private sector, it relates to a range of things. As I said earlier, if you've got excess capacity, you're not going to expand or invest unless that capacity is already utilized. That means you need to have a growing economy to utilize your spare capacity. If you have a question, and again it comes back to technology is constantly innovating, and therefore the ability to, and this is, as I said, not just a domestic issue, the ability to have employment in the areas that we want. We've got technologies that are developing in those areas. You find that they need more, fewer people to operate them. So part of it is recognition, and you've seen that in terms of the strategies of the National Development Plan, what government has put out, is to focus on the areas which have the best opportunity to create jobs, which is in your real economy, is in your primary sector, is in agriculture, and that's what we need to focus on, and to ensure that that works. And I think that that has been a clear commitment in terms of that. If you look at unemployment and the measures, I mean, what we need as a country is a common sense of purpose. We have differences, as every country has, but we have a common sense of purpose. And the National Development Plan is the only document, other than the Constitution, that has been adopted by all political parties in Parliament. And therefore, it gives you the frame, it gives you the vision, it gives you the alignment that you want. So work out the detail in the implementation, things that there will always be differences, but work them out. And create that sense of uncertainty. On inflation and upside risk, you know the answer to that. If inflation rises, and that's why we've expressed real concern about the upside risk to inflation and that inflation expectations remain anchored at the upper end of the band, you know, the answer is down the line, if that's what you continue and that's what happens, we get the tools of central banks remains your interest rate. So, you know, it's why we are very clear, and we've said repeatedly, we've been more tolerant of inflation at the upper end of the band, given the challenges we have of slowing growth. But in the end, our primary responsibility is inflation, and we will act accordingly, remain ready to act accordingly, should that be our forecast that that is where it's going. At this point in time, we're pointing to upside risk. Colleagues, you want to add any other questions? You want to do this, please?
No, Ms. Adams, I wanted to respond to a question in Africa. But I realize that my Africans as a child laborer in Kwams in Musina is very different to the Africans that spoken in Cape Town, not the one that spoken in Kimberley. So I'm going to try and not venture into that because I've realized that Africans can be very complicated sometimes. But this issue around pyramid schemes specifically, it's something that is very worrying and very painful at the same time. We decided as a bank to, this year, launch the campaign, but not necessarily alone as a bank, but launch it together with the FSB, the National Consumer Commissioner, and include the National Credit Regulator, because we have realized that these people, this process tend to find loopholes between the institutions that are supposed to regulate one or the other forms. We don't have the time to go through the details, but I'll give you one of the scheme which the governor referred to that took 200,000 people and just a little less than R1 billion money was gone. Okay? By the time we arrived at it, there was only about 300 million left. Okay? So 500 million had gone. Now, let's assume after everything has been done, if you were going to then have to get your money back, the possibility is you may just get 20 cents out of each rand that you have then put in. Now, this is a consequence of greed. And the reason why we have launched this campaign is to say that an informed public should be the first line of defense. Now, let's move forward. So for those who are born before computers, but do have cell phones and they can see cell phones, unfortunately, the fraudsters tend to use one form of cell phone, which is a Nokia. So whether you are using a BlackBerry or an iPhone, they still send you a message that says your Nokia has won £750. Now, why do you respond to it when you are not using a Nokia? You are using something else, but you respond to it. That's so it points to greed. Or someone comes and says to you, you have won the £2 million pounds lottery. You know that you don't have a passport. You have never been to the UK. But you want to respond to this thing. So it can only be greed. Now, we say we can do all we can. We can never be able to close down these things. We rely on the public to start saying, look, this is our money. We are not going to get conned. We are not going to respond to this offer. So I've given you two types. The third type is what relates to Parliament, by the way, is that there's a lot of letterheads, this thing that we call 419 scams, lots of letterheads that are supposed to be from Parliament that bears the signature of the Speaker of Parliament, but it uses a Yahoo address or a Gmail address, and you respond to a Gmail address and a Yahoo address when it says it's from the Parliament of South Africa. How do you ever respond to that? And the response number is a cell number. There's not even a landline. Since when is Parliament not having landlines? And since when does the Speaker of Parliament use the Yahoo or Gmail for purposes of his work? Now, these are the kind of things that people get conned on around pyramids, or you get asked to recruit more people. Anyone that says to you, put in money, but go recruit more people, immediately tells you you're dealing with a pyramid scheme and you are bound to lose your money. That's all we can say to our people. So they just need to stop really responding to these things, because it's a product of greed and you end up in tears because the money will be gone.
Thanks, Governor.
I'm assuming that that was the last round, as you said, so if I could perhaps just respond on something else. First of all, to thank you all for the opportunity. We find this a very important part of what we regard as being accountable to Parliament. And as I said before, we are more than happy to come to present to you. And, you know, obviously, if one can plan it. I know that there's pending elections next year, and that may change some of the timetable availability. But perhaps just to reiterate, as we have before, is that post-Parliament, post-election, we're very happy to host the committee in Pretoria to give you a sense and take you through the kind of induction we would do as to what is the work of the bank and how does it work. Because you may, well, if, whoever is here, you've been there, so it would be perhaps with some new members, but always a refresher and the ability to interact in that regard. And to really suggest that, you know, we are available for on a number of issues. One would be the annual report. We think that's important to do. The second one would be on the report of the bank supervision, and as we get twin peaks and the reports that would be required out of that to ensure that those reports are discussed in Parliament. And then your third question would be in terms of either the medium-term budget, which obviously those are the fiscal side of things, but economic environment within which that occurs. So we would be available to meet with you on those or any other occasions that you would like. And therefore, to thank all of you for the questions and the comments and the thought that has gone into it, and also to the team from the bank. We really do greatly appreciate this opportunity. Thank you.
Thanks, Governor, Deputy Governor, and the rest of your team. Let me also just start by what the Honorable Harris raised in his input. But the frequency of our interactions with yourself would have loved to be much greater than what it is. But as you know, we work within certain parameters in Parliament. But for me, the little time that we always spend with you is very, very fruitful and very informative to the committee. And I wish we could be able to improve on that. I've just whispered to Ellen here that immediately after the MTBPS policy statement, probably as we go into the public hearings, one of the things that we want to have is to have an interaction with yourself. We'll see how we manage that process. Of course, we'll be informed in time. So that don't inconvenience, that they will not be looking for you, maybe the MPC will be sitting. And so we don't want to, you know. The second is generally, I think, in terms of your presentation in the global outlook, economic outlook, I think for us, as South Africans, really, the message that I'm getting is that there are domestic challenges that we need to pay attention to ourselves. One of the key issues that has been raised in the public discourse is that
We cannot only talk about global or FDIs. Why is capital in South Africa not investing in the economy? Why are companies sitting on huge sums of deposits in banks and not? For me to invest as a foreigner, I need to get confidence from those who are inside, that they've got confidence in their own economy. I think that's one of the things. The other issues about labor and all those kind of things. For me, I think we just have, and I think you've covered that, there is a serious violent polemic between labor and business. They approach things from miles apart. But the key question is whether NEDLAC is a forum to tease issues, or is there a notice place? You know, now we are giving a notice that we are going to retain 15,000 workers. We are giving a notice that we are going on strike. I don't think that platform is being used adequately to achieve and maximize dialogue so that we can have results within the very shortest space of time. And the last NEDLAC platform that I attended, I also observed that. So I think there's a need, but it's not for Parliament to pose question to the Reserve Bank. What must be done? What can be done? It is ourselves as Parliament who can also come up with suggestions on how we think things can be improved. I think it is very, very critical that we do that. And once we are able to carve a space for ourselves in terms of this dialogue, not permanent dialogue, I think we'll be able also to say what kind of a message do we need to communicate to South Africans. The Deputy Governor gives a whole analysis of since 1996 about the IMF up to 2010. Those positive aspects not what we communicate. I think we sometimes take pride in whipping ourselves with salted meat. It's like everything is just bad, it's horrible in South Africa. When in actual fact, the positives are there, but in our narrative, we focus on the negatives. I think it will be important that even as we write and we communicate, wherever we are, is also to lift out the positives and say we're addressing the two or three challenges that we have. That doesn't say we are acting, you know, to the maximum on our part as leaders. And leadership is about the entirety of society, wherever we are, whether it's political party A or political party B. Leadership is about business, it's also about labor. Fingers must not always be pointed at government. Government this, government that. When in actual fact, we've got a platform for all of us to act in a responsible way. So I thought I should just make this observation. But we'll take everything that you have actually shared with us to be a basis for the committee to interact with unfolding programs of Parliament. And where need be, we'll always interact with you. But I must also thank you and our office for persistently reminding the Chair that there's an annual report. You've not called us. And I think you must never be tired of that. Let's continue to do that. Otherwise, we'll be sitting here if you're not for your office, honestly speaking. And it should not just be about the annual report. When the matters of national importance that you feel at the economic level, you should actually also say, Chair, we think we need to appear before your committee, not to account, but just to share information with yourself. That will also give us a very, very important space to can deal with the issue that we are supposed to deal with the Parliament. And once more, thank you very much, Governor Marcus and Deputy Governor and the rest of the team. Honorable members, thank you very much for your very insightful questions that has actually made possible for the team from the Reserve Bank to share this information with us. Thank you very much. The meeting has adjourned until further notice. No, that presentation we have expanded it for the Auditor General. It will come next week. So we are done. Thank you.
Chair, can I just say that I know we are going to get the door stopped so by members of the media.